everybody. I'm Jeff, and I'm joined by Skeet. How's it going, Skeet?
Good, brother. How you doing, man?
Doing great. So we heard from Evan, Dr. Sories, and Anton last week about empowerment in action. And when I think of the concept of empowerment, my head goes to one of our core principles of self-actualization. And I'm excited to be back today talking about the principle of self-actualization. So, Ski, my first question for you is, you living your best life?
Oh, man. Absolutely, man. Like, life is grand. I mean, with flights being on time the other day, you know, kind of getting me in and out of places, and family's good, brother. I'm living my best life.
That's great, man.
What about you?
Doing well. Doing well. This is a subject that I have taken a pretty deep dive in over the last year. As you know, and I think our listeners probably know pretty well at this point too, self-actualization has become kind of one of the go-to things that we talk about. It's really been elevated in the Stand Together community as a principle that that's really important to us. It's always been there. It's one of the first things that I learned about when I learned market-based management back in 2007. But it's really kind of come to the forefront in terms of our focus at Stand Together. And I personally couldn't be more excited about that. When we first started really elevating self-actualization, one of the things that occurred to me was, alongside some of the other principles that we've talked about on the podcast, it seemed weird to me. It didn't seem to fit in the same way that a lot of the other ones do. Mm. You know, things like dignity and mutual benefit, to me, those are kind of obvious societal principles. But when we started talking about self-actualization, my first thought was, well, that's kind of like just about me, right? That's a thing about how I might live my best life. I might understand and grow into my full potential. Where have you seen that? Where have you seen that self-actualization has become the key result of the partners that we work with?
You know, it's interesting. You talk about the, you know, self-actualization and when it was introduced, and you know, it was something that was great for you. Like, you immediately gravitated towards it. You know, I think for me, I didn't understand what in the world it meant. So for me, I had to take a little bit of time to kind of go, all right, so what in the world does this even mean? And to your point, I mean, for a long time, we talked about humility and respect and you know, kind of facing reality where no matter how painful it was, you know, in the vein of humility. And so this self-actualization came about, and it was like, it was all about self. And for me, I was like, well, no, but I'm actually not all that interested in self. I'd rather go do something for other people. And then it kind of dawned and clicked because I had somebody go, well, that's a lot of what self-actualization is all about. And I was like, oh, okay. Well, so say more. So then that's when I kind of began to go on my journey of understanding more deeply about self-actualization. But I'm glad that I've been on that journey to further understand it, because it is transformational with our, you know, partners. It literally is like at the cornerstone of everything that our partners are working on. And, you know, for our listeners, I mean, we'll hear shortly from Kirk Brown at Handy that it's the key cornerstone. The reason why the leaders of our partner organizations are doing what they're doing and why their broader organization even exists is so that the organization can go on this journey of self-actualization, truly trying to pour into the lives of other people so that those being impacted by the organization can yet go do the same thing to folks that that they interact with. So I'm excited to unpack with you, Jeff.
Yeah, you talked a little bit about kind of going back to basics. Listeners probably don't know this, but I have a bachelor's degree in psychology from 20 years ago. Ah. So I'm a social media psychologist. a big part of my interest in psychology going back that far was really this idea of human potential and kind of being frustrated that the field of psychology often studies what's wrong and doesn't spend enough time studying what's right. And most of our listeners will know the one thing they've heard about this subject is hierarchy of needs and Abraham Maslow, right? Maslow was one of the first psychologists to really say, hey, you know, there's plenty of folks studying what's going wrong. let's study what's going right. Let's study people at their best.
Yeah.
And let's really dig into trying to understand what human potential looks like and what the process of reaching that potential looks like. And that was really the key for me in seeing our partners as unleashers of human potential and barrier breakers that get in the way of people being able to reach their potential. Self-actualization not being something that you give to other people, that you can make other people do or create for them. What you can do is remove barriers and create space for that to happen. And this idea that maybe we've underestimated human potential, maybe we've sold people short a little bit on what they're capable of. And I know that some of your experiences that we've talked about in prior episodes, working with, say, the Phoenix and other partners, you've seen that firsthand in terms of individual people walking through the doors of a Phoenix gym and their life being transformed. They will self-report having done things that they never thought they would do in their lives because of their involvement with the Phoenix.
You're so right. And at the Phoenix, I mean, there are folks that are walking through the door at the Phoenix, and we talk a ton at the Phoenix about the, you know, kind of the 1,000-pound door, which is pretty heavy to walk in and cross the threshold. But their lives become, you know, transformed. I you know, remember a story from one of the Phoenix members named Nick, and Nick was homeless and just wanted a shower. And he saw the doors of the Phoenix and eventually kind of came in and he just wanted a shower. But one of the folks at the Phoenix said, well, hey, you got to get a workout in. And so, you know, he ended up, you know, working out in order to get a shower. And he left and he said, I just kept coming back every day. And the environment that was created there at the Phoenix, he said, hey, they didn't push me. They didn't prod me. They knew exactly what I needed, without talking, you know, a ton, you know, to me and with me. And eventually Nick became he was sober. He got sober. He became a volunteer for us, so leading some of our classes. And actually now he's an employee with the Phoenix. And so he would tell you he would have never, ever imagined that would be a part of his life. So, yeah. So and I think there are those stories across, you know, our entire Stand Together community, partners doing amazing things, helping others self-actualize.
I think my personal favorite Phoenix story is I admitted to them that I have a deep fear of heights, like the kind of fear where when I'm up high and my body shuts down, I can't function. And of course, immediately they're like, you got to get on the climbing wall. And I was like, that is the opposite of what I'm going to do. And sure enough, I get buckled into the climbing wall and the guy is, you know, my lifeline is clipped in and I'm going up and he starts to tell his story and he says, you know, I never thought I'd be doing this. And my first thought is, this is not the time to tell me that.
Yeah.
You know, I need this to have been your life calling. But when he talks about his own journey and his recovery story and realizing that whole new world of opportunities was available to him and that his experience with the Phoenix, both as a team member and an employee, was integral to that. And then I started seeing that all over, right, across the portfolio of partners that we work with, where they might be working on a million different things, working with different groups, different populations. But the thing that ties it together is that they've identified a barrier to self-actualization and they've worked to break that. So I want to introduce a couple of things, maybe some nerd philosophy stuff to frame the conversation, get your thoughts on it, and then we'll get Kirk in here to share his story and to plug into some of this. So I mentioned Maslow, a little bit about the history there. He passed away in 1970, relatively early in his life, and probably had a couple decades at least of work ahead of him as a scholar had that not happened. And by the end of his career, he was really studying this idea, like I said, of people at their best. And he'd introduced a couple of frameworks and concepts that have really shaped my thinking on self-actualization. The first is the idea of people existing on a spectrum at any given time between what he called the deficiency realm or the D realm and the B realm or the being realm, like the idea of the wholeness of being. And an author that we use a lot, Scott Barry Kaufman, kind of makes a joke in his book about the fact that we created a word for when we show up to the world with a deficiency of having our hunger needs met. We call it hangry,
yeah.
Right? And he challenges people to say, well, let's look at the other needs in the hierarchy of needs and talk about how we show up when those needs are unmet. You know, when our human connection needs are unmet, when our self-esteem needs are unmet. So my first hard question for you, Ski, and we're going to get Kirk on this later too, is how do you show up sometimes, let's say maybe less than ideally, when some of those baseline needs are unmet? What does that look like for you?
Yeah. Oh, man. That's a man. You put me on the spot. My goodness. You know, it's interesting that you put it that way, because I think now I understand that you got a psychology degree. I just got a business degree out of, you know, from college. So maybe that was why that first introduction to self-actualization didn't hit me nearly as immediate. But yeah, you know, I think a lot of it, when you talk about food, shelter, belonging, and it really, I would say for myself, I get a bit worried when those needs aren't met. And I also recognize what it feels like when those needs are met, and you know, the types of behaviors that I exhibit. I like that, how I'm behaving in that space, versus when some of those basic needs are not met, it's worried, anxious. And I consider myself an optimist, but when some of those, you know, those basic needs aren't met, I mean, I recognize that in that moment, I'm not the person who I enjoy or like to be.
You hit a key word, this idea of belonging. And it's something I haven't thought as much about until recently, until really kind of elevating this self-actualization principle. But I'll say for myself, when I feel like I belong somewhere, that opens the door to me being my best in that group of people. And yeah. When I feel like I don't belong, I'm obnoxious.
Yeah.
My clamoring for belonging turns into, quite frankly, something that's probably going to make it less likely that I am welcomed into that group, right?
Yeah. Oh,
That unmet belonging need really turns me into a version of myself that I'm not proud of. And I think Maslow's point with this deficiency realm versus being realm is, take a concept like love, right? To say I love you from a deficiency realm is more like saying I need you, I desire you, or I value what you solve for me. Love from the being realm, if I bring a full, well person into any kind of relationship and I love that person, love looks a lot more like admiration and mm-hmm. adoration and celebration.
Right.
How much of what we think is love is really deficiency realm love, D-realm love, where we are clamoring to have a need met,
right,
as opposed to simply celebrating, adoring the people around us. And so that's Maslow's idea of how we become and how we treat others. Maslow had this idea that when we are self-actualizing, we naturally become other-regarding.
Right.
We don't need to convince people to care about others. We need to help people self-actualize, and they'll care about others naturally.
Right. So, Jeff, really quickly on that point, what do you think about how conditions or the environment that someone is in and the impact that, you know, their environment has on the choice around whether to be motivated by the D realm or the B realm?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's actually my second philosophy nerd point that I introduced earlier. All of my thoughts are stolen from Maslow. He wrote a paper that actually came from an interview that he gave, and the paper is called Eupsychia, which is a made-up word. And he was trying to get this to take off. He was very unsuccessful in doing that. But as a kind of a counter to the idea of utopia, so if utopia is material abundance and we all have all the things we need, he wanted eupsychia to be mental abundance, emotional abundance, wellness. He put out a thought experiment that I think is kind of interesting. He said, you know, picture two desert island societies, 1,000 people on each. One is 1,000 random people assigned randomly, and the other is 1,000 highly self-actualizing people. And he asked, you know, what would be the difference between the two? And he sort of concluded that the highly self-actualizing people would create culture and thrive in ways that the other couldn't even imagine, and that we, the reader, really couldn't imagine what would happen. Because while the other society might engage in, you know, exchange, and they would help each other with their hunger needs and their thirst needs and their basic connection needs and all of that, the other society would be consistently identifying and solving higher and higher order needs, working with each other at varying, increasing levels of self-actualization. Then he goes on to talk about, well, what would that actually look like? To your point about environment, what would that look like? And his conclusion is ultimately that the thoughts and behaviors of the people in that culture would be more around understanding and supporting needs, so that people could spend more time in the higher levels of the hierarchy. And that's something, as you know probably better than I do, is a key part of the management philosophy for Stand Together, right? Is that we don't just try to hire great people and ask them to do well, although we do that. We try to build in a lot of things into the organizational culture and the management philosophy that create the environment right. that help people more likely exist at higher parts of the hierarchy than they would otherwise if they were somewhere else.
I think that's a great point, and I completely agree.
All right. Well, we're going to take a short break, and after the break, we're going to be back with Kirk Brown from Handy to talk about his story, his organization, and the role that self-actualization has played in both.
All right, welcome back. And I'm super excited to be joined by Kirk Brown from Handy. How you doing, Kirk?
I'm doing well.
Awesome. So, quick question for you. I mean, are you today living your best life?
No doubt. I'm definitely, you know, representing in the universe and also building in the universe that I exist in. It's beautiful.
Oh, that's outstanding. Well, Jeff, dude, I mean, we got Kirk Brown hanging out with us, man. I mean, how do you feel about that?
Well, now we definitely are living our best life. That is 100% true. Kirk, I saw you a few months ago talk to our catalyst in Austin, Texas, and sitting there listening to you tell both your story as well as the Handy story, I immediately went to self-actualization. Now, I might have a bias that I have acknowledged on this podcast so far, but I heard both your own growth and identifying your potential and having your, I believe you call them your solid ground people, help you see that. And then I saw very directly how that was built into Handy. So I'd love it if you could tell us a little bit about you and what you do at Handy.
So I'm the CEO of Handy, but also my proudest moment is being someone of lived experience in the environment with our young people and the team that I lead. The team that I lead and the team that also leads me, right? So to be realistic, you know, for those who didn't hear the talk itself about solid ground people, I'm just a youth born in extreme poverty in the Caribbean and had some wonderful people really take personal stake in seeing my human value. They didn't see me in need and think I was needy. They saw my talent, abilities, and, you know, drove me towards a purpose. And so I was blessed to have that. And, you know, when I became a professional and saw that, you know, you could really, you are the universe in which you build, right? And so being able to look outside of myself and really see, I know what I look like at 14. I see it every day in my building, you know, and I know how self-actualization really leads us to elevate beyond just self, right? And go into those places with other individuals. It really, for me, speaks to about the how you do things, right? I could give you a gift card to buy food, but if I put it in your hand, hold your hand, look you in the eye, you'd be surprised how many people in need never get looked in the eye, right? Look you in the eye and tell you we're here for you. That's the how. That is the care and the compassion that goes into seeing human value. And I strongly believe that seeing human value and instilling human value leads people to actionable self-worth.
I think this is a subtle point that gets overlooked a lot in this conversation, but the difference between seeing need versus seeing potential, seeing need versus seeing value. Tell us a little bit more about that in your own story.
So for me, I was in need. And there were individuals who really believed that you're born with talent, right? You're born with talent in you, but if someone doesn't see it and cultivate it, it never becomes your abilities. And so there are people who really invested in the fact that, you know, you're smart, saying simple words of affirmation. My math teacher was the first person to tell me I was smart. You know, I didn't believe it at the time. You know, and it just stayed consistent with it and treated me like a human being.
And Kurt, and what at what age was that?
Oh, wow. That was like 11. And staying consistent with it. I think consistency is really key on the human value spectrum. But there are so many of us that go through life in need. And because we're in need, people forget that there's talents, there's hopes, there's dreams, there's purpose in that life. And we, for us to elevate, as I heard a portion of what you were saying earlier, for us to elevate as a being, we have to be able to see value in each other.
I love that. And we talked on a previous podcast about inherent dignity and treating all folks with dignity no matter what. And I think that's a huge part of it and really a big connection to self-actualization, a big reason why we would prioritize self-actualization in the first place.
I mean, when you talked about abject poverty at lunch, you described what that was.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going like, yo, yep, that's, I mean, I grew up rough.
Okay.
Right? I grew up rough. But when I went to your home country.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I saw what poverty looked like when people are lacking some of those basic needs. I mean, you lived it.
All right. So when we talk about poverty, and I mentioned being a poor kid from Jamaica, I mean, you know, there's still things that make rationally no sense to me. Like, I'm from a place where I saw people fight over the food that they found in a garbage can, right?
Wow.
So when you're living at that level of existence, right? Those basic needs are things that are elevated to kind of like a want, right? And so when you come from that level of existence, it's different. And so the first time someone saw me, like human to human saw me, I remember crying. I remember, you know, I grew up with no father. So the first time, just in passing, so this guy just said to me, I hope you have a good day today, son. That's the first time I was ever called a son.
Wow.
And I remember it just froze me. And it threw my entire week off, right? I went to school that whole week. My head was in a daze. So I know what it looks like when our young people walk in our building and their head's in a daze. It's not something as extreme as people believe, but being called son for the first time shook me, right? And that belonging to something shook me. So when my math teacher told me I was smart, I was the smelly, dirty kid in the class with the anger problem.
Wow.
And yeah, I showed up with anger. I had a lot of reasons to show up with anger, right? You sleep the night before and get rained on and show up to school the next day, you're going to be angry. And so when he made that value proposition to me from a moral perspective, I didn't know how to treat it. I remember I was in shock. I was like, smart? Me? Nah. You know, immediately I was like, nah, you're probably mistaken. But he said it the next day. And he said it the next week, even after I cussed him out, because I was an angry teenager. And so I stuck in it, and he kind of like really molded me in that aspect. When I came to America and my teacher, I wrote an essay, and the essay was about, you know, what you want to be when you grow up. I said alive. Because at that point, 90% of my friends were already dead.
And how old were you?
I'm 16 years old.
Okay.
Right? And they died gruesomely. So, you know, I'm sitting there and, You know, I look at this English, you know, question, and these are the wonderful things in literature class, right? They ask you these profound questions, and when they ask people like me that question, I hope they're ready for the answer, because I kind of like, okay, let me write about, you know, I came up with all of these things, but I just want to be honest. What did I want to be at 21? Alive.
Mm.
What's your five-year plan? When you ask someone that comes from extreme poverty, what's their five-year plan? They're like, I don't know if I even have dinner tonight. That five-year plan is not really resonating with me, right? And so when I got asked that question and I answered the question in the essay, Alive, she came over to me, I think 2 days later, and she said, you should go to college. This was greatly written. And I'm thinking to myself, what's college?
Mm.
This story brings up a point that comes up a lot as a criticism of self-actualization and as a focus on self-actualization is that a lot of times it can come across as being ignorant of needs. So we're going to focus so much on the positive, we're going to focus so much on the potential that we forget that people have needs and that people exist on a spectrum of needs being met, even down to those fundamental needs. What do you think about that? How do you look at your own experience through the lens of both acknowledging the existence of severe want, but also having a focus on potential and value?
That's a great question. The severe want, I do believe, is a preparation for actualizing the value. I look at it and go, you know, I stayed outside in the rain for 3 nights in a row. I was in my college algebra class. I was like, yeah, college algebra is easy.
Mm.
Right? I know what it feels like to go to bed at night without food to eat. You mean I got accounting 101 tomorrow and I'm sleeping in a dorm room with cold air conditioning, right? It becomes the way you lens and view it. But when it comes to the value part of it and the BRAM, right? Get into that place from the DRAM to the BRAM, right? Sometimes we view the DRAM as a crippling effect because it's a need instead of a journey that your life is going through that is preparing you for that greater value statement, right? I call it grit, right? Greater retention, in greater resilience, intention, right? And so when I look at that from that perspective, I see it in our kids. I see it in the families that walk through the door. The grandmother that walks in, and she is in the DRAM. She's living the DRAM. But we walk her over to, there is purpose in what you're doing. There's abilities in the kids that you're caring for. And then when she sees that we care is when she starts valuing herself as a caretaker, right? And then she starts seeing what that family can become.
I was wondering if you could give folks kind of the deep dive on how Handy does that. What do you guys do? How does it result in that impact that you just described?
Well, it's three simple areas for us. It's 57 services boiled into three different areas. It's you walk through the door, we're going to embrace you. We're going to meet you at that DRAM. We're going to embrace the need that exists. And we're going to embrace it with a very tight embrace, not a, you know, not something that's short-lived. It's a long-term embrace. Hierarchy of needs. You know, you got your food, your shelter, your clothing. We're going to make sure we're not talking to a hungry youth about workforce, right, or employment. And so we embrace, and then we educate. And we educate around the sense of belonging, around education itself, your value in the human system, your value to society, and that you play a role in all of us winning. And that you play a role in our community becoming great. And from the education, we empower. We walk you over to empowerment because I can't tell you about the workforce. I can't tell you about your economic value statement or even your moral value statement in the workforce society if I don't tell you you have a value from an educational perspective. And so those three simple factors is given to everyone that walks through our door, whether they are homeless, whether they're in 10th grade, whether they are the 65-year-old grandmother who's going back to work to take care of her three grandchildren because the mom is in jail and the father is deceased, right? Whatever walks through the door gets embraced, knows, and gets educated about their place in the world, and then gets empowered to make this a better place for them.
So share with our listeners an example of, you know, an embrace. So someone, and you can mask the names if you need to, but somebody that came in, got that embrace, got the education, and had been empowered. Like, tell us a story.
So I'm going to tell you about 10:05 a.m. this morning, Brian. So my phone rings, and it's a phone call from Alabama. And I'm like, okay, who's this? I don't know the number. Unlike most people, I tend to answer my phone for numbers I don't recognize.
Yes.
And so, because there's so many of our young people out there. So I answer the phone, and it's Brian, and he starts talking about, you know, I know you guys put me in construction, and I got a certification, went well, but I'm not in construction anymore. But he immediately goes, oh, but don't worry. I'm working for this wonderful place. I'm making $35 an hour. I'm a great father. I have my baby. You know, I'm engaged, but I'm scanning her, which means he's still evaluating the situation, right? And I'm listening to him for like 15 minutes, and he's just downloaded. You know, he's just telling everything. And I live in a 3-bedroom house in Alabama. It's cheaper than South Florida. He's right. Right. And he's going and he's going and he's going. And then he just pauses and says, thank you. Mm. And when he said thank you, I realized this is a call you give later on in life when you've reached that place and you're just sitting there. And he was like, I'm sitting here in my sweats on my day off, and it just hit me.
Mm.
And he called. Now, in some societies, that's a call you give your relatives, your mom, your dad. When that ha-ha hit you, like, they were right.
Yeah.
You make that phone call. That's the empowerment that I'm talking about. That is, he's reached his potential. He's reached a place where he now sees the pouring in. And then he goes on a call. He says, and I want to do something like Handy. So how do I get something like that starting in Alabama?
Yep.
And I'm like, okay, so now he's reaching outside of self. Now he's reached a place where he gets to create his universe of him. Because we all live this life every day saving ourselves, right? Or implication of ourselves. And so that's where he is. That's 10:05. That happens every day. Another example is, you know, my girl T. Can't say her name, but it starts with T.
Yeah.
You know, angry 14-year-old will cuss the teacher out at the drop of a dime, live with her grandmother, went missing for a year. We found her, brought her back. And, you know, she graduated from high school, and she's accepted at 8 different colleges.
Mm.
This is a child that 3 grades behind in math, 2 grades behind in English, and about 5 grades behind in social interactions, if you know what I mean, right?
Yeah.
Every second word was a curse word. Like, who are you looking at? He's just looking at her, right? And then there were so many levels and layers of not belonging to anything there. And so once we showed T that she belonged, once we embraced her, now she's just confident, just, you know, flying above your head, looking at down at you like, okay, get on my level. You know, she's just like overly confident. You could see it. You could see that thing about her that is, there's something there that is greater. That self-worth is just permeating. It's just all over the place. We find joy in that. We call that success.
So take us back to the embrace part for T. So embrace and then educate, and maybe even for Brian. Because you say the Brian call happened today?
Today.
Like today, like before today. Before coming in here to record, like all today. That. Today.
Yeah.
Wow. So maybe kind of take us back to the educate and embrace, because it sounds like, I mean, what you've described is a lot of the empowerment piece that we're seeing that manifested, but what was, you know, the embrace like?
The embrace is hugging thorns.
Okay. So say more about that.
Okay. So the embrace is hugging thorns, and I really believe that, you know, the deeper we go into the DRAM, we got to learn how to hug thorns longer. And so Brian came in, you know, child of domestic violence, beaten up himself, persuaded to deal drugs. He was a very skilled marketer, right? And so he would have gone far in that game.
Yeah.
And if not for us pulling him aside and saying, you know, Brian, if you can sell drugs at 2 a.m. in the morning on the most dangerous streets out here, you really can do business management.
Yeah.
Right? There's a lot of risk associated with that.
Right.
Your ability to persuade people and really dove into that world to pull him out. And that's what the embrace looks like. And then walking Brian over to things that he's really good at, simple things, right? Mm. Not complex things, daily goals. Hey, Brian, today I want you to come in with your pants at your waist.
Ah, simple.
Simple. Hey, Brian. Today, I want you to convince everyone in here to pay attention to the life skill class. Why I gotta do that? Because, Brian, you have a power of persuading people. He doesn't know that yet because he's using it in the wrong direction. Right? Sales and marketing 101, right?
Right.
So you have the power. You have the talent. Now, let's show you that you have a talent that we're going to form into an ability.
Mm.
That's the embrace. Helping to subsidize his rent with his uncle, right? Helping him to get a job and subsidize paying for his employment, right? We're in the background also doing that. His case manager is also taking him to regular youthful activities because Brian has never been a child.
Ah.
And so Brian chose construction, the educate part. What's your value? What can you really do legally that won't put you in prison?
Yeah.
Right? And Brian chose construction, and then Brian went to Georgia to work for a construction company. We paid for the certification, right? And so Brian calls now at this stage saying, I chose that, but like most of us who went to college for something else than what we're doing.
Yeah, right.
Right? I chose that, but I found out I elevated to this, and I'm really good at this, right? So that's the embrace, the educate, and empower Brian.
I'm hearing a cool trend here in the story, whether it's T with college admissions or Brian's story, both with the housing and the job. A lot of times when people think about programs in our sector and you talk about a housing program, it's about getting the house. And if you're talking about workforce, it's about getting the job. And if you're talking about college admissions, it's about getting into college. But the way you described all of those stories, there's something else going on in each one of those stories, something else about the relationship that you build with the person that seems to be the factor that makes it helpful. It's the barrier breaking side. Can you talk a little bit more about that across Handy's work?
So it's the who inside of the person that we see, right? And so like I'll bring it to this. I literally almost walked off of a college campus my freshman year because of imposter syndrome. Like I looked around and I was like, I do not belong here. Like these kids from they have two parents, right? I'm sitting there like, oh no, this is not me, right? And then I met Chemistry 2. That was the class that made me decide, maybe I'm not a college student, right? Everyone has had that class, that bump in the road where no one else is present, all the people who whispered in your ear and talked about potential. And then you had to have that talk with yourself in that moment to say, I can step over that. That's the moment we work with our young people to prepare them for. That moment where doubt seeps in, that moment where you have to jump in deeper. And so it's the who, right? And so for them getting accepted, we have kids who don't get accepted to college, but they're in the workforce. But it's how they show up, who they show up as, that's really important to us. Because we don't want to make highly successful, dysfunctional people. We really don't want to invest in that. We have enough of that.
Yeah.
Right out here. So we want to spend our time and our equity statement in human lives investing on what are they on the inside?
Mm-hmm.
How are they going to treat people? Right. How are we going to grow this outside of us. Like, if I help T, I have no doubt that when T gets to where she's going, or even on her way there now, she's tutoring middle school students right now, she's already manifesting that hope, right? Putting those hands together to build that net to help the rest of society. She's already doing those actionable things that tells me that somewhere she's self-aware that she has a greater value statement here. And that is very represented in how we treat other people.
There's something really beautiful about that imposter syndrome story, because imposter syndrome is just quintessentially D realm, right? It's I lack the connection and self-esteem to feel like I belong here. Mm-hmm. And the antidote is people providing that sense of belonging, mm-hmm. right? It's a community. It's surrounding each other with that support that we need to truly feel belonging. And what that does for opening up our potential is so huge. So one of the things that we cover on these principles episodes that I wanted to definitely hear from you on is how these principles show up internally with our staff and our leadership inside our organizations. So the pitch talk for self-actualization as a organizing principle is we want to build organizations that help each and every person that comes work for us be as likely as possible to find their thing and do the heck out of it, right? How does self-actualization, how does this helping people live in the B realm happen for staff at Handy and leaders as well?
Oh, we make it fun. We do great things. We do great things. The first part is owning the greatness that we are together, right? And knowing that all of us show up with talents, but it takes all of us to manifest the abilities. And when you fall in love with those abilities, it becomes purpose, right? And so there's nothing more. We hire, even in our hiring, interviewing and hiring, right? 5 years ago, we had a candid conversation in the lunchroom. One of my social workers walked in. She was so frustrated. She said, "This ain't for everybody." And I heard what she said. And then as a leader, I really heard what she said, right? And then I had to ask myself, is she right? This is really not for everybody. Mm-hmm. This is not for your regular candidate straight out of college. I just learned social work from a book. Social worker, it's not, right? Because on any given day, someone's walking in every day with mass trauma. And she was just like, and she sat down and I'm listening as a colleague, first of all. I'm not the CEO. I'm a colleague. I break down all of those barriers of people lying to you because of a position, right? I'm a colleague. And she's just, venting over some coffee. And she's like, "I was with this person for 12 hours yesterday, and then they called me this morning at 7 o'clock, and she's back on the street selling her body." And she's so frustrated. I'm listening. And then when she got close to the end, I said, "Okay, so tell me then, why do you do it?" She was like, "That was my mama.
Mm.
And she does it in my neighborhood." And she teared up. And in the back of my head, I'm like, I'm so proud to serve with her.
Mm.
So I walk into my executive team and we're talking. I was like, "Do we interview for this?
Mm.
Do we interview for lived experience?
Mm.
Do we interview for people who it means more to them than a job?" Because what we're doing here is more than just a job.
Right.
And how do we interview for that? And so from then, we started interviewing for lived experience. We started interviewing for understanding of the communities that these kids are in. Because we really need purpose-driven people in our building. Right?
That was my first question. If it's not for everybody, who's it for?
It's for people with lived experience. It's for people with lived experience that see this as something greater that matches their abilities. And sometimes what we try to do is we take circles and triangles and try to make them into circles. We just have to be honest in our environment, right? Who will be happy here, right? And but at the same time, asking yourself, why are other people not happy here? But who would be happy here? An interview for it. And what we found, just doing that one small dynamic of starting to interview for it, people walked in with massive talents, not for mm-hmm. the position we hired them for. And then we started, you know, every month asking them about their abilities. You know, if this was your organization, what would you do with it?
I love that. One thing I find really hard to remember is that for every job, no matter how awful that job might sound to me, there's somebody in the world that job will make them come alive. I wonder if you have a story about anybody at Handy who has a job that would drive you up the wall, but they do it with the passion and fire that you're talking about.
Her name is Esther. Esther is my director of education. And if you're one of my university partners and you're listening, I really enjoy partnering with you. Thank you for all that you do with us. I know on any given day, Esther is an angel and also a thorn. And so Esther goes hard in the paint on behalf of all of our young people and our families when it comes to post-secondary education. My fondest moment for Esther is I'm in my office and I look out the window and she's walking through the parking lot just punching her hand in the other hand. And she looks so frustrated. And I'm like, oh God, is she going to quit today? And I walk out there and I'm like, okay, so what's going on? And she goes, we have to do better. I'm like, okay, I like where this is going. What can we do better at? And she's with so much passion and vigor just telling me about post-secondary education and if we just did this, or we need to do this. And I know we don't have enough money to do this, but we need to do it. And I'm listening to her. And 2 years before she became our director of education, I knew she would be our director of education because that kind of passion and zeal matches up. And she has the talent. She has the abilities. And when I was talking to her, it was already her purpose. Like she was, you could see it in her eyes. Like this woke her up in the morning. And so when she got into the director of education role, you could just see it. Everyone in the building just rejoiced about it because she literally will walk into a middle school, a high school, a post-secondary institution. We're forming 4 educational institutes in our own building. And that is all because of the vision and that person self-actualizing in our environment of our greatest purpose, right? And I can't, you know, as an organization, we're made up of the bodies of the people that are there that find joy there, right? And so for me, it's Esther.
I love that. Yeah, you don't have to convince people to find their purpose. You just have to let them.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And so let me maybe go back to this idea of lived experience mm-hmm. and ask you, like, why? Why is that so important? I have a theory, but I want to ask you, like, so why is that so important to you, to the people that work at Handy? And the students you all are serving.
You ever been sort of hugged?
Yeah.
You ever been really hugged?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's the difference. So it's kind of like, you know, what you know, you'll dedicate 8 hours to. Mm-hmm. What you've lived, you'll dedicate a lifetime to.
Right.
And so, you know, it comes with a different level of zeal when they do it. Understanding, and for the population we serve, they want to know that people are not just visiting their neighborhoods to fix it. They want to know that people are in it with them.
Right.
And they wear it as a badge of honor. And so interviewing for lived experience and even educating others on lived experience, I think is very, very important when we're serving communities that need hope.
Because I assume, like, for you, because of your lived experience, there's something kind of welling up in you that you are passionate about this work and will, you know, go tear after it, you know, in a way that you likely wouldn't have otherwise done it if you maybe didn't have that lived experience. And then I'm thinking about the people that work at Handy same way. And they're getting benefit out of it because they've had these lived experiences and they're getting benefit from helping and paying it forward and all of that. So they're benefiting from it. And then the students are benefiting from it. Right. So you kind of see where I'm going here with, you know, for you and then the people that work at Handy and then the people that you're serving, everyone is getting benefit from these lived experiences that you all have.
Oh, yeah. The mutual benefit spectrum is pretty high for us. Like, you know, you walk in and the level of belonging and fulfillment every day is it's just wonderful. I don't have a day at work where one of my team members don't walk over to me and tell me about their Handy moment, right? Like, I had it today. And sometimes there's smiles and sometimes there's tears, but the tears always come with how they solved it. And it is great to be able to serve, to my psychology major friend over here, people who, you know, their lived experience lives in the DRAM. But what they're creating is the BRAM for so many other people. And so it's so beautiful to see scars become stars, right? And so that kind of, for me personally, the live experience is kind of like my prerequisite for what I do.
Mm.
I can't put it on the resume.
Yeah.
You know, my resume, for like, I can't really put it on the resume. But, you know, it's kind of like a prerequisite for what I do and understanding better what I do. Right.
Yeah.
And understanding what I need to do and still learn and grow every day in it.
So what was I got a question for you regarding your own self-actualization journey. Mm-hmm. When was that moment that you had felt like in some ways making the switch between like that D realm motivation to more of a B realm, whether you knew it was D realm or B realm back, you know, then maybe when was that moment for you?
So I have to thank both of you for this because you made me think about it. And so for me, it was a homeless kid in a Coca-Cola shirt on a street corner in our neighborhood in Broward County. And I'm driving my Honda Civic fresh out of college on my way to law school. I'm enjoying life. And I saw a homeless kid in a Coca-Cola shirt. And then it all just hit me, right? These scars can be stars. Because not many people can tell him about the wind that blows at 2:30 in the morning when you're homeless.
Mm.
And get the respect from him that it deserves. Because he knows you know.
Right?
When he knows you know, you could tell him about it.
Uh-huh.
And so I saw that and I was like, it was just like a ha-ha moment. It was just like, I'm going to go fix that. I call that youthful ignorance right now. But, you know, it was just like, I'm going to go fix that. Or it should be fixed. And I got angry about it. I got passionate about it. I had a social work degree at the time. But that moment is when I was like, yeah, this is it. And you know, we have a saying, go for broke.
Yeah.
So I just decided we're going to go for broke. This is what I'm going to do.
Yeah. Awesome. And then one other thought. When did you realize, I assume younger age, when did you realize you had value?
Ooh. Mm. You know, those solid ground people. I knew why I had a little brother that looked up to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I was like somewhere close to 14, 15. I had a drug dealer told me, you know, you can't sell drugs. I was like, why? I know I'm smarter than y'all. He was like, this ain't for you. There's something greater out there for you.
Oh.
And I remember looking at him like, are you high? But, you know, the weirdest people spoke words of like compassion and just like planting seeds. And for me, it was like 14, 15 when I realized that, you know, there's something greater. I have value. I have value. It's ground shaking because it's confusing too.
In what way?
It's really confusing when people tell you you're worth a lot, but you're living in need.
Ah.
Right?
Really?
It's a dichotomy in the psyche of people who are in desperate need. And, you know, you're smart. You're going to go places. And you're like, but I sleep with roaches. Like, it's not adding up right now.
Yeah. How do you reconcile that? Because, right, to your point, I mean, it's not adding up. Like, so, like, how does one reconcile that? Because I would assume you certainly want to believe, mm-hmm. you know, these folks telling you all these great things about you. But reality, and maybe falsely, though, but reality says you're living with roaches. So these two things can't coexist, I assume, is likely what's going through. I mean, how do you reconcile that?
Like, you know, dreams live in hungry stomachs, right? So dreams do still live in hungry stomachs. And I compare it to being heartbroken, and people say, but there's love out there for you, right? And it is that place where you have to stay, the embrace of Handy. You have to stay with the thorn. You have to tell them it's going to get better. You have to build daily goals to show them it's going to get better. And for me at 14, I started collecting gems. I started to collect simple ray of lights, people that walked in, people that invested. And that's what our team does today, right? You know, we're saying these things, but we're doing these things. We're making them actionable. And so... It is a reality for people in need in the DRAM, telling them that the BRAM exists, telling them all of these things, but showing them, because need doesn't mean needy. Need doesn't mean not talented, not lacking of abilities, or not having a purpose. Mm-hmm. It just means you're willing to fight harder for it.
Yeah.
And tapping into that, right? Tapping into that is where the self-actualization comes from for me.
Yeah. So, Kirk, in the work that you're doing, I hear you talk about the embrace, the educate, and then empower. And so, you know, it feels like you're on the right track when you're talking about those three elements of how you all do what you do at Handy. But there's another school of thought, you know, I think there's, you know, several more, but another school of thought that says, well, hey, you know, at some point along these lines, maybe before the embrace at Handy, but maybe, you know, hey, there's some discipline and some punishment that some of these, you know, young folks that are walking through the Handy doors might need, you know, some punishment, severe consequence in order to kind of, you know, almost maybe scare them straight or something before, you know, maybe an embrace from Handy, et cetera. I mean, what are your thoughts about this idea of, you know, kind of punishment is potentially necessary throughout that process, especially if they've, you know, they've misbehaved?
I think that's a great lie we tell ourselves. And I call it the great lie because I have two points on this. The first point is you can't do anything to them that life has not already done, okay?
Wow.
The kid selling drugs at 2 a.m. on a street corner, life got him there. Then wake up in the morning and go, you know what? This is a great job choice. No. There's enough punishments and consequences in that life. And so I call it one of the great lies. The other great lie that lays behind that is the fact that we behave as if people need to earn love in our society.
Ooh.
People need to earn care in our society. And we have to be cautious about that because it says a lot about us. When someone has to fill out 7 pieces of paper to get $50 for some food.
Wow.
Right? For you to tell me your eye color so I can feed you, right? Like, that is kind of like some of the things we do when we have more than others. And we're going to help you.
Wow.
So that is really a diagnosis of me seeing you as needy.
Ooh.
Right? Not in need, needy. So now you got to earn. You got to earn my love. You got to earn my care. And immediately, the minute I know that, because I've been on the receiving end of this. There's an elegant book written, and a woman is sitting in the food stamps office at the state. And she talks about what she sees as a person in need, right? looking through the lens of the person in need, knowing you got to earn food, care, love, or even your smile. One of the things we remind our young people at Handy is that we don't invest in perfect children. You are allowed to fail here.
Mm-hmm.
We tell our caregivers, you are allowed to fail here, because failing, falling off is human. Yes. No matter what word we give it, you know, we could call, some people might get offended with me saying failing, but onboarding and offboarding on life, is that better? Right? You're allowed to do that here. Because you know when you really make a great human value statement? It's not when the person's on the mountaintop giving their best life Facebook post. No, it's when they're in the valley and they're ignoring social media. Like, for real, for real. No one posts it's like, I'm having a really horrible day today. Look at me. Right? It's those moments. And so the punishment, the consequences, the need to earn care and the need to earn love is more on us than it is on those young people and the people that really need to walk into self-actualization. Because if you really think about it, if that was your reality, would you want to be punished?
Wow, Kirk. I mean, yo, man, I'm actually now a little disappointed that you dropped that knowledge on us. And Jeff, this is our last episode together, man. So, man, we got Kirk here who's dropping this wisdom. I'd love to unpack that. Kirk, will you come back again? Because
Definitely.
I'd love to unpack that point and a few more. I'm all fired up, Jeff. I mean, I don't want to end this thing, man.
Yeski, I actually think I have a longer list of questions now than I did at the beginning of this episode.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And maybe, though, that's part of what, you know, we're talking about self-actualization. And, and I think Maslow once said, what a person can be, you know, they must be. And so, therefore, it's about kind of growing. And we got more questions because we're growing. So let's... Man, I'd love to just kind of keep the thing going so yes. that we can, you know, learn more, apply more, learn more, apply more, and keep that rhythm going.
Yeah, it's the whole, the more you learn, the more you learn you didn't know.
Yeah,
so
oh yeah.
We'll have to boot this up next season. Well, guys, it's been awesome to be here today, Ski. It's been incredible to do this series with you.
Oh, yeah.
Folks at home, we are so excited that you tuned in with us. Please jump in next week for episode 13 with Ty Spells on Empowerment in Action. Thank you so much, and we'll talk to you soon. The Stand Together Podcast is a product of the Stand Together Foundation. It's produced by Bittersweet Creative with executive producers Obiakwe Okolo and Robert Winship. Editing, engineering, and sound design by Robert Winship. Our title track is Being Nostalgic by Flyin'. The principal's intro music is Everything by Tilden Park. Extra special thanks to producer Molly Ringel and Elgin Cato for herding cats and filling in the gaps that made all this possible. I'm Jeff Proctor, and from all of us here, we'll see you next week.